And morning meetings on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we have belonging time. And so to the point that you mentioned, it's not too early to start having these conversations, as we have conversations about what does identity mean? What does race mean? What does ethnicity mean? What do these things mean? And how can we engage in those conversations? Because what we recognize is the earlier we have those conversations, the easier it is to do the work and to prepare our students for potential difficult conversations. And we do it in a way that really speaks to our population of students.
Hello, and welcome to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast with Winifred A. Winston and LaDerek Horn, the show that unapologetically focuses on helping Black and underrepresented minorities navigate the special education process. We want to help raise awareness in the Black and Brown community, remove the stigma about learning disabilities, and provide you access to professionals in the space of dyslexia and special education that you need to hear from.
Today's episode is proudly sponsored by the Lab School of Washington, D.C. At the Lab School, they understand that every child learns differently. That's why they are dedicated to providing personalized education for students with learning differences, including dyslexia. With specialized programs tailored to individual needs, their experienced educators empower students to unlock their full potential and thrive academically, socially, and beyond. Discover a nurturing environment where every child is celebrated for their unique strengths. To learn more about Lab School, go to labschool.org. That's labschool.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast. I'm your host, Winifred A. Winston.
And I'm LaDerek Horn.
And we are back, you guys. No, we haven't been gone. We are super excited. Today, we have with us Dr. Anthony Perry. He is the Director of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging at the Lab School of Washington. For those of you that don't know, the Lab School of Washington was founded by Sally L. Smith. If you listen to the show, you've heard me mention that. She is like my mentor in my head. And I'm super excited to have Dr. Perry with us here today because this is the first school for children with learning disabilities that we've actually featured on the Black and Dyslexic Podcast. So Dr. Perry, welcome.
Thank you.
So your role, and Dr. Perry and I first connected because I received an award and an acknowledgement for my work from the Lab School during the pandemic, and then had the opportunity to come and visit in person. I thought maybe just if we can just start with the DEI and belonging title. So I think our audience is probably very familiar with diversity, equity, and inclusion, but why belonging? Why is that an important addition to the title?
I would say that, I don't know if it was after my first year or after my second year, one of the things that we thought about as an institution is that what's really important is a sense of belonging, right? So I think about sort of Sally Smith, back to the illustrative Sally Smith, is I think that the school that Sally founded was a notion of like, hey, the world or the school system isn't reflecting how it is that my child learns, and I want to create that space. And so as much as, and diversity, equity, inclusion, and all those things are really important, but what the goal is a sense of belonging, that as we diversify the population, as we're more inclusive, as we're more equitable in our practices, really what we want is all of our students to have a sense of belonging. And so I think my second year, our head of school said that our sort of theme was going to be belonging for that. I mean, we kept it for 2 years, and that belonging was added to my title.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Being a private school for children who learn differently, how does the work that you do play into the student population? Because let's be clear, the majority, we only know of one school for children who learn differently that is majority Black. And that is what, in Nebraska, right, LaDerek?
Right.
Any other private dyslexia school is majority white. And I feel like when I saw that belonging on the title, it resonated because as a previous director of admissions, when you have a family come into your school, you want them to feel welcome. And and we know culturally, we're not that comfortable going in spaces, but we don't see nobody that look like us. And as a parent, we look on that, we look at that directory and we look and see what is the makeup. So as a former director of admission, I wanted every parent, no matter what, when they came in that building and we toured and I talked about what we offered, I wanted them to feel like, hey, you belong here. You can see yourself here in this school. So what does your position, how does that play into the mix of the students that you receive?
As you were talking, I was getting a little emotional, which was strange for me for this moment. But I think, there are many aspects to that. And I think that when I took on this job, one of the things that I wanted to ensure or work towards is that I get to show up as me, right? Mm-hmm. I am a Black man, I'm a gay man, I don't have any language-based learning differences, but part of it was like, I want to be able to show up as myself, as a Black person who's gone through primarily white institutions. I went through public education, but as a person who's gone through that, I recognize that even if we like don't think about the language-based learning difference, just being a Black child going through an educational system that wasn't made for you, that is primarily white, that's a struggle. And so one of the things that I really tried hard to do was to be able to show up authentically me. And one of the sort of moments that I thought about was during the pandemic, we had the opportunity to sort of have Zoom sessions with parents. And so one of the things that I did was just sort of tell my story of like who I am, why it is that I show up. And I spoke directly to Black families, like in a session that was for all families, I focused on Black families. And, you know, that could have been, you know, a bad move because it's not a primarily Black institution. But what I got from that was I got so many messages from Black parents to just be like, oftentimes I just go to these and I know I'm not the target audience, so I'm half paying attention. And so part of what I recognized in this role was that in all of the spaces that I'm in, I have to think about targeting a group of people who may not be the target audience. And so when it comes to thinking about the start of the school year, like I often talk about Rosh Hashanah. And so I do these things in a way that can be more inclusive and that, you know, the potential ideal student is not always who you think it's going to be. And so that's sort of how it is that I play into that. With respect to admissions, the director of admissions, he has a bigger title, like admissions and enrollment management. But one of the things that we talked about was how it is that we can ensure that families of color are able to have this real conversation. And so my first year, we started Zoom sessions that were for families of color. We have like families of color admission sessions. And our first year, we didn't have as many people come to them, but we had people come to them. And part of the thing that I like about Lab is they really let me go off and say the thing. And so being able to have that conversation with families about what it's like for your Black child to come to Lab, what is the actual lived experience? And so what we thought about was the next year, we moved it up. We moved sort of when you sign up for things, the families of color session is higher on the list. And we went from, I would say maybe 20 people overall over the whole year to like having like 20 to 30 people per session. And a lot of the feedback from families was that they just really appreciated the authenticity of the conversation, right? That we're not an institution that has a lot of, you know, a tremendous amount of Black families in the way that we would like, but I tell you where you are and what your child's experience will be. I mean, that can keep going on, but that's sort of part of how I've thought about thinking about what you said about admissions is that that's part of the conversation, part of the recognition that we are in the Palisades in Georgetown. And so that's a particular environment that may be different for people who aren't from the area. But one of the things is we have a sort of a Black Lives Matter sign up in front of the school. And some people have pushed back on us having that Black Lives Matter sign. But part of what we have received is feedback about that given what the neighborhood is looking like, given where we are, and given, you know, how the world is changing with respect to their people's support of diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging initiatives, that they appreciate that we stick to this idea that the Black Lives Matter.
Dr. Perry, that is huge, right? Like, as you were talking, just to focus the session on Black families, mm-hmm. that is huge. Some people might think that's just a small thing, but mm-hmm. one thing, you know, we're at a predominantly white school for my daughter, and we had a gala, and I went up to every Black family and was like, hello, I'm Winifred. I'm saying hello to all the Black families here. And they were like, some people eyes got big and some people just smile. I saw a sigh of relief when I'm at the cross country meet and I see mm-hmm. Black families. I go introduce myself. And one guy said to me, he was like, thank you, sister. He said, I thought I came to the wrong place because I ain't seen nobody that looked like me. And he was there supporting one of the children running. And I just say, hello. Hey, Black family, mm-hmm. I see you. And that small thing makes a huge mm-hmm. difference because there are a lot of little nuances that Black families won't necessarily speak up about. And the one that mm-hmm. kills me is transportation. Mm-hmm. That, mm-hmm. Everybody mm-hmm. don't have an au pair, okay? Mm-hmm. Everybody don't have an au pair to come.
You bring them to school, right?
Yeah. Exactly, mm-hmm. or to pick them up. So for you guys to say, hey, we're going to have this info session in a space where you can feel comfortable where you don't feel like you can't ask a question like that. Thank you. Like, I just like that. That's huge. That's super huge. Can you talk about, I also saw that you are a history teacher, and my daughter has really been history. I think her social studies slash history teacher doesn't like to be called a social studies teacher, because she says, like, I tell the history from every angle. And she's a white woman and she goes in. They learn it from every angle. And again, we're at this predominantly white school, and this white teacher is taking the initiative. I'm going to teach you guys everything that I can from every angle. So how does that show up in your work as a teacher as well in that space?
Well, hilariously. So I, when I took the job, the plan wasn't to teach. And then some people's schedules changed around, and I was asked to teach a class called History of People of Color of America. And so it's an elective history class. Ninth graders through 12th graders can take the class. And the class came about because students wanted the class. They wanted a class that specifically talked about the history of people of color in the United States or America. That's the class that I teach. And we talk about, we start off with Indigenous people, we talk about Black people, Latinx peoples, Asian peoples. We talk about the ways in which the variety of ethnic and racial groups have participated in the construction of the country. And, you know, some people willingly and some people not willingly. And so we really talk about that. And one of the things that I love about Lab and I love about teaching at a school like this is each year it's somewhat similar, but it changes based on the interest of the students. One year a student was like, can we talk about environmental racism? I was like, of course we can. One year a student was like, I don't really feel like we've talked enough about Asian peoples. Let's do that. And so my particular class, we have sort of textbooks, we have a plan, but that plan is always amenable to what the students are talking about, what's interesting to them, and also what's happening in the world, right? So my first year was the election. And so part of the conversation was around, how do we prepare students to understand people of color's relationship with elections? And so we talked specifically about Georgia. We talked about Black disenfranchisement in Georgia. We talked about, you know, we did a lot of work in preparation. And then, I don't know if you remember that time where we were all sitting around waiting for the votes to come in. But part of what was interesting for my students is we had already talked about all of those regions in Georgia and Arizona where certain demographics of people live. And so they were able to use what we had talked about to really understand the election. And so sort of the freedom that I have in that class to pivot and to think about what's interesting for my students is super impactful. And we know that, I think one of the things that I like about teaching at Lab and thinking about supporting students who have language-based and attention-based learning differences is that the differentiation that we do for those students supports all of our students, right? All of our students will learn better if we teach in this way that's differentiated for what their interests are, what to get them enthusiastic about it. And it makes it fun for me. I can change it up from one day to the other. We, you know, I had a class where one of my students said, you know, I don't really, the Black Panther movie, eh. And I was like, what do you mean, eh?
Right, like, right. Those are fighting words. What are you talking about?
I was like, it doesn't really do anything. And I was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, well, like, talk to me about what you know. And this is a Black student. I was like, talk to me about what you know about the Black Panther Party. And they're like, I don't really know anything about the Black Panther Party. And I was like, well, then you didn't get the movie. Right. And so part of what we did, I was like, okay, so we're going to go learn a little bit about the Black Panther Party. We're going to learn about Black women's role in the Black Panther Party so that when we get to the second movie, you can understand sort of the dynamic of the movie. And the kids at the end were like, we can't watch any movie anymore, Dr. Perry. Every time we watch a movie, we have to think about the construction of all these identities in the movie. And I was like, well, that's what I want you to do. But really, that's sort of how I get to be excited about the work that I do in the classroom, and being connected to the students really helps me to better understand the work that I do. If I understand what their experience is like, they have my ear to be able to give me feedback on some of the things that we're doing. And so I get to teach, but I also get, you know, every Tuesday and Friday, they get to give me feedback on what it is that we do as an institution.
I think it's phenomenal. My wife and I just saw the stage play To Kill a Mockingbird last night. You know, we've been talked all night, talking this morning about, you know, and deconstructing the characters, but it sparked us having a conversation about her experience going through AP English and history classes. And one of the things that I said is, and you're doing it, is how I don't think history is really effective particularly as far as being taught to students, unless it's mm-hmm. being placed within the context in which they're living now and helping them to mm-hmm. understand the problems which we're all actively wrestling with nationally, internationally, but also just like, mm-hmm. how does this apply to the fight that just happened in the cafeteria or, you know, mm-hmm. whatever kind of dynamics are happening in the school. So mm-hmm. that's amazing to hear. I wish I had you for history. So Dr. Perry, we've heard you mention a few times how you got to lab. So can you actually just give us the backstory? How did you end up at this school and in the position that you're in?
Mm-hmm. So I've had a variety of experiences, and I've always worked in independent schools and private schools. I worked in private schools in New England. I worked at boarding schools. That's where my career started, working in boarding schools. And so I will say that the sort of aspect of working in boarding schools that I really got was recognizing my role as a Black man, as a gay man, and being able to sort of show up as myself and support students. Because in boarding schools, students are not with their parents. We have day students, but for the most part, students are showing up and we are in loco parentis. We're the people who are there to have sometimes the awkward, difficult conversation about life. And so that was really a part of my understanding of how learning works. And then I was able to go to California. And so I worked at a school in California for gifted students. And so that was my first sort of foray into students who learn differently. That part of the conversation was around neurodivergence and not sort of relying on the ways in which I thought you're supposed to learn to teach students. And so in my first year at the school, I had a student who had dyslexia. And so mom showed up, had a whole packet of all the things that I needed to do to ensure that her child was supported. And I was like, oh, okay. But part of it was she sent me an original email, she sent a book, and I'm a reader. And so I read the book by the time we had the meeting. And so I was like, okay, so I read the book that you sent me. These are the things that I've adjusted for the class. And actually they work better for my class because, you know, we're a language class. And she was just dumbfounded. She was like, oh. And I was like, well, I want your child to participate and to learn in my class. And oftentimes, actually, I was a language teacher at that point, oftentimes with language classes, students who have dyslexia get waivers and they don't take language classes. And what I really appreciated was that the student really wanted to participate in the class and wanted to be involved. And I didn't want to make the student feel like things were different or I made adjustments just for them. So one of the simple things was, in language learning, part of it is, you know, reading, writing, listening, speaking. Those are sort of the four large categories. And so what I had was, for sort of major assignments, students would have to do one reading, one writing, one speaking, one listening. But you had to think about either where is your skill that you want to practice, or where do you feel like you're the strongest, and the ways in which you turned in assignments for the rest of the year had to do with that, right? So if you felt like you could practice more speaking or your skill was speaking, that was what you did, because then you were able to practice that skill. But also, if that was your strongest skill, then you were able to do that instead of sitting there and writing a, you know, 5-page paper. And that really changed how it was that I taught, because students were far more interested when they had options of ways that they can turn in the work to me. And also, students who didn't have dyslexia benefited from of being able to listen to a text that we were reading. And so I happened to have a friend who was a writer. And so I asked her if she would just record the short stories that she had written for my class. And so all students were able to listen to at the same time that they were reading the short story, because it's a second language for many, right? And so second language acquisition sort of mirrors first language acquisition in some ways. And so part of how I know how to teach a language is around ensuring that there are sort of multiple avenues for students to get the information. And so that's my foray into changing or creating a classroom that was a little more inclusive to think about how students learn. And then it was the pandemic, this job came up, then it went away because of the pandemic, but then it came back. And one of the people who worked at Lab was someone who I worked with at a previous school. And similar to something that Winifred said at the beginning was, I went to the website. I was like, how many Black people do you have here? Right? If I'm going to do DEI work in 2020, I need to know how many Black people work here. What does the work actually look like? And this was a Black man who I really trusted, who was really a part of my growth as a teacher. And so, you know, I had the interviews, but then I had the conversation of like, okay, so like we had that conversation, but like, what does it look like on the ground? Like, what is the lived experience? And so we had a real conversation and I was like, okay, we have some things that we need to do, but I think I can do this. And so part of what I heard was that, you know, I need to support Black students. I need to support Black boys, right? That, you know, in general, there aren't a lot of Black men who are teachers. And then thinking about Black men who are teachers at LD schools and the presence, I think it's super important. So that was part of the drive and to be a part of the school.
Wow, that's amazing because, you know, as you were talking about even teaching the second language, a lot of parents shy away from a foreign language without mm-hmm. even giving the child an opportunity to see if they can grasp it. My daughter will be entering high school next year, and we just did the schedule. And there was so much talk about, oh, are they going to pick Spanish or Latin? And then a parent was like, can they do American Sign Language instead? Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, depending on what college they want to go to, they won't accept ASL. They'll need a language. And I'm like, I was thinking in my head, like the director of admissions hat was like coming on my head, but I wasn't speaking up, but I was thinking, we know what we're doing. We know how to teach them. Let us teach them Spanish. Now, granted, I'm not on the team there at the school. I'm just a parent, but my director of admissions hat was going on like, parents, it's going to be okay. We can teach them Spanish. They will learn it, you know, and I took Spanish and I remember my English always improved. Like my English, my papers, my grammar, everything was always on point when I took Spanish. And I was one that was afraid to speak, but I could understand and I could write grammatically correct in Spanish. And then that's when I learned that some of my colleagues who were Hispanic were illiterate, right? But you don't think that because they know how to speak Spanish, but they're speaking broken Spanish. And I'm like, wait a minute. And he was like, no, I didn't finish school. I was like, oh, okay. But it always helped my English. And I would have been that student to say, let me write the paper. Let me write it in Spanish because I was afraid to speak, but I could understand very well. So that is awesome. So talk to us about some of the work that you do. You talked about the Zoom sessions, which I think are amazing. I really love that. I wrote that down and I'm going to make sure I spread the word about that. I like that concept. But talk to us about the work that you do in your school that is not, I want to say, highlighted in a sense that you have certain families that come, you know, there are certain staff members that are already there. But as Black folks in predominantly white spaces, there are some nuances that we see, you know, children bring some things to school and they say something. So how do you address that? How do you address that in that environment?
That is a marvelous question. And it's something that I actually was thinking about. So we have a lower school, a middle school, and an upper school. And on Thursdays, our campuses are in two separate places. Our lower school is separate from our middle school and upper school. And so on Thursdays, I get to hang out at the lower school. It is such a, and I was literally having this conversation with the head of the lower school that I recognize in the moment that I had yesterday how important it is for me as a Black man to be in spaces with Black boys. Not to say, obviously, that other people can't, but I think, you know, we have, I get to be one of the facilitators for our boys group. And so there's a Hispanic man and there's me, and we're the facilitators for the boys group. And we, you know, we will spend 20 minutes during lunch and we'll do some sort of activity. Usually they love basketball. And so we usually end up playing basketball, which is a team building activity. You see them interact with each other. And I think some things that have come up. So one of the students was like, Dr. Perry, why do you paint your nails? Boys don't paint their nails. And I was like, well, they do, because I'm a boy and I paint my nails. And the thing about that is that they were just like, yeah. Like, it just, like, it was a Black boy. He was like, yeah, you told me, I listened. And I think that there's, you know, I think for them, sometimes there's a, they may read me in a certain way that may not align with what they think, right? And so we play basketball. And I think, you know, sometimes because of the painted nails, even though they're a basketball player with painted nails, they may not think that I know about basketball. And so we were having, they were, you know, arguing back and forth. And I was like, I don't need you to explain to me the rules of basketball. I used to be a basketball coach. And they're like, what? What do you mean, Dr. Perry? And so just being able to have that conversation with them, and also recognizing part of being able to support them is being able to, is also having an understanding and a knowledge of who their parents are. one of the things that I talk a lot about is that we don't do this work as teachers on our own, that it's a relationship that we try to build with families so that we know that we're supporting how it is that you want your child to be able to show up, right? And so the benefit that I have of working in the lower school on Thursdays is I get to do morning arrival, right? So I see the kids and their parents when they drop them off, I open the doors or they get off the shuttle, we have a conversation and we're building that relationship. And so when it comes to some of the students in the boys group, I know their parents because I see them at morning arrival or we've had a different conversation. And I understand, you know, the nuances of what it means to be a Black parent and dropping your kid off at lab, right? And that we recognize that actually, like, it, you know, it feels a little different when you're a Black parent, you drop your child off at lab and a Black man is the person who opens the door. You're like, oh, okay, right? And that, and part of something that's sort of similar is, you know, as a person who speaks Spanish, and I worked at other schools, and we would have these, you know, parent nights, and we would have parents who did not feel as comfortable in English as they did in Spanish. And I remember walking, I had a similar role at a different school. I'm walking with a parent and I say to the parent, oh, I speak Spanish. And they're like, oh, okay. And then I started speaking to him in the Spanish. They're like, oh, you speak Spanish. So then the conversation became every question that they had that they couldn't ask in the larger space. And so part of, you know, that role that I have now is, as I'm walking, I have those conversations with Black parents where they have the question about, you know, do we go to this? Should I ask for this? And I'll say something that, you know, I've talked to Black parents about, it's okay to advocate for your child, right? That oftentimes when we get into these spaces, we have this level of gratitude where we don't want to rock the boat because we're so grateful that we've arrived to the space. And for me, I'm like, yeah, but if there's a true sense of belonging, that the things that you need, you can ask for. And if it means that you and I have a conversation where we figure out how to word that in a way that gets what you need, sure, we'll do that. But you can ask for what you want and ask how you want it. And that part of my role is to ensure that those individuals who may not be a part of the culture are not misreading you, right? Because I've often had conversations with parents across the spectrum of times that I've been teaching where, you know, Black women will feel like, I don't want to be the angry Black mom having the conversation, right? And it's like, do that. And then I'll be the person that comes behind and be like, did you listen to what she said, right? Like, it's not just about how she said it. And I think part of my work is really talking to our administrative team. And we have a lot of conversations about recognizing that because of the places that we come from, we read people in a certain way. A story that I shared with my school when I came on was like, I want you to understand the amount of energy and effort that it took for me to pick a picture that went along with the bio that you were going to send out. That I asked my sister, I asked my husband, I asked so many people. I was like, what about this picture? And there was one picture that I really liked. And my sister was like, actually, you're not smiling enough. They're going to misread you. Right. And so part of it is like, I want you to understand that as a Black person working at this school, I spend a lot of effort really thinking about how I'm going to be viewed, because I know that sometimes I'll be misread. And that's a drain, right? And so when we think about parents, you just want to support your children. You just want to show up so your kids can, you know, read and enjoy learning and do all those things. And so part of my role is to sort of make sure that we're not misreading parents and ensuring that parents feel like they have the space to be able to have those conversations. And I've seen in the lower school, in our middle school, in our upper school, just the space that parents are taking to be able to advocate for their children. Because it's a relief when it comes to like, oh, you know how my kid learns. But it's also like, you know how my kid learns and my kid's Black, right? And my kid may be trans and my kid may be Jewish and my kid may be, and I need you to be able to support that identity as well.
Oh, I wrote it down. I love the level of gratitude because that is absolutely true, because that's something that I have to explain to my white friends who are allies. I'm like, as a Black woman, I always have to check how I'm speaking, my tone, my energy, everything. And we often come with that level of gratitude and other parents don't. When I was director of admissions and a student didn't get in, when the parent would call me, I'm thinking, I would never act that way. I would never say that. Oh my gosh. And it was this like oh, we didn't get in. Thank you. You know, I would never think to, oh, well, who else can I speak with? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. And we talked about that before, but you're right. It's this level of gratitude. I'm just so happy to be here. I'm so happy you let us in. Like, I'm happy that we made a way to financially make this happen for our family. Mm-hmm. And you're so right. And that muffles our voice and it shuts down the opportunity for others to get to know us. Right. Mm-hmm. And not just go based on what they see and what they think they know. Oh, I love that, Dr. Perry. That is so true. There is a huge level of gratitude when we get in these spaces for our children that we are just happy to be there.
Mm-hmm. And that creates this sense of that you're like the perpetual guest, right? Like that, like if you're, if you're so gracious to like, if I'm walking into a space and I'm like, I'm so grateful. It's like, oh, I don't want to touch anything. I don't want to mess anything up. But part of it is like, no, when you walk into this space, that chair that's there, that's for you. You sit, you make yourself comfortable, right? And you ask for a water, you ask for what it is that you need. But I think, you know, that's a reflection of the larger society when Black people are able to get into spaces that aren't necessarily made for us. And I would say that I don't do this on my own. I have a team of people who are supportive. You know, we've, you know, increased the amount of Black folks who work at Lab. And so being able to have different iterations of Blackness on campus has been super impactful. That, you know, I am and thinking about the senior leadership team, right? Like, I don't want to be the only Black person on the senior leadership team because my experience is not vast enough that I can represent the spectrum of what it means to be a Black person in independent schools. And so as we think about and we work to ensure that our senior leadership team is diverse and that our staff is diverse. So I really think that I can't do this alone. And part of the work that I try to do is to, this is a thing that I do that people laugh about, but I do it intentionally. I try to walk into spaces and make people uncomfortable. I will, like, it's like if I walk into a space and I'm the only Black person, I'm like, oh, just like, it's just me in this space today, right? Because I want you to know that that's something that I'm thinking about, even if it, you know, may not matter to you. If I walk into a space in 2024, I'm the only Black person in that space, and not just like the only Black person, but the rest of the people are white. I'm like, oof, what's happening? You know? And I want, and what it's helped actually is that other people then ask that question, right? So I really, my relationship with the director of admissions is so great because what I really appreciate is that he's a person who listens. And so he will come to me and be like, I was in this meeting and it was just a bunch of white people. And I was wondering, where were other people? And then he asked that question. Like, what I really appreciate about the growth of our institution is that I'm not sort of the person that people have to go to check. Like, they're listening to what it is that I'm saying. They're listening to the PDs and they're asking the questions because they recognize that in order for us to get to where we say we want to be, we all have to be doing the work. We all have to be asking those questions.
Yes, it has to be embedded within the culture of the school, right? So that it trickles down to all faculty, some faculty who may have just been in their bubble, right? Because it's not brought up in discussion, folks don't talk about it, but then it also plays a part in the classroom when you have students engaging with each other for that adult, for that staff member to correct some things, right? To say, let's open this up for discussion because in one of our experiences, I mean, yeah, I've heard this on the podcast, we won't go there, but the staff member didn't correct it. She just ignored that behavior. And then my daughter came home and told me, mommy, you know, the student said X, Y, and Z. So it's very important that the entire staff, the culture of the school is on board with addressing things and talking about it and discussing it. And children are not too young. I just want to put that out there. Elementary, middle, high school, we've got to have these conversations.
And I'll say that it's not to say that we are perfect. If we were perfect, I would be the Mark Zuckerberg of all these things and everyone would be benefiting. And I think that what you said is so important and that's something that we have really, I think, worked to embed. I have the privilege of working with a lower school. I have coordinators in each of the divisions. And so one of the things that we worked on is having something called belonging time in our divisions. And so we piloted it in the lower school. And so we have responsive classroom and morning meeting. And so in morning meetings on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we have belonging time. And so to the point that you mentioned, it's not too early to start having these conversations as we have conversations about what does identity mean? What does race mean? What does ethnicity mean? What do these things mean? And how can we engage in those conversations? Because what we recognize is the earlier we have those conversations, the easier it is to do the work and to prepare our students for potential difficult conversations. And we do it in a way that really speaks to our population of students. And so this activity you may have seen in other spaces, but sort of the jelly bean activity where we have the students divide all the jelly beans by color. And that's related to the conversation around race. And so you have all these blue jelly beans and you're like, ah, these are all the same race. But then you taste them and you realize that they're all different. And that's ethnicity, that even within that racial category, there is, you know, a difference in ethnicity. And that's, you know, the flavor, so to speak. And what we really recognize is that oftentimes people think that if we're going to talk about race, we're going to have this conversation with elementary school students about power and privilege. It was like, mm-mm. We are thinking developmentally appropriately about how it is that we have this conversation with these students so they understand it. And then when they get older and we go to middle school and upper school, we nuance that definition. We have further conversations around it. But if we don't provide them with a baseline, then they're not going to be able to engage with that work. And so we do that through read alouds. We make sure that that vocabulary that they're learning, that they're embedding that in other spaces. And so when we think about the work that we have to do, it's sort of everywhere all of the time, but I really appreciate what you said about ensuring that it's not too young to have those conversations. Sometimes by the time they get to middle school, they've already cemented some ideas about things. And we know that from children's experiences, if they don't come to lab, you know, with respect to their language-based learning difference, that they may have a certain view of what it means to be dyslexic if they've been in a school that hasn't supported that identity and they come in the fifth grade or they come in the ninth grade. And so because we recognize that and the impact of really being able to give students the tools to advocate for themselves around their learning difference, we really should do that for all of their identities and start off from the beginning, because part of it isn't, you know, sometimes people have this fear, if we talk about gay people, children will be gay. But part of it is we have diversified our population and we have students whose parents are gay. We have students whose parents are trans. Right. And what we want and what we say is that children are building relationships outside of the home. And so you have, if you have a play date and you haven't had a conversation with your child about what it means to have two moms, right? That's a conversation you're going to have, right? Because if you drop your child off and they're like, oh, there are two moms at this house, we've never had this conversation. That part of it is really to prepare students for the world as it exists, that people have two moms, people have one mom, people live with grandma. And so part of what we talk a lot about is about family structure, because we do have some students, a significant population of students who are adopted, right? And so assuming that, you know, a family structure looks like that, it's only going to put our students in a very awkward position. And so we talk a lot about the diversity of families and what that looks like. And that's super helpful for them to be able to acknowledge that, you know, you may see me and you may assume that my parents look a certain way because my skin color looks a certain way, but actually I have two white parents or something like that. How do you have that conversation? Because they're going to ask those questions when they're young, like, you don't look like your mom. Right. Yeah. What does that mean?
I asked that question with my daughter and she was like, Ma, like, why did you ask her that? And I was just talking about her name. Her name is unisex. And I was saying that most Black little girls have that name, but then white little boys have that name. And she was like, why did you ask her that? I'm like, because I don't know. She could have adopted. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what their family. I don't know. And she was like, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense then. But I was one of those parents that did think, oh, she's too young. But I had a wake up call. And then I went to a speaking engagement about how do you talk to young children about racism and ethnicity and race? Because I was like, I need to arm myself because the world won't be kind and say she's just too young, right? It'll just happen. Mm-hmm. She'll have those experiences. So that's what made me say, oh, wait a minute, let me think of this differently. But everything that you mentioned that you just discussed is really important in the more affluent private schools, because folks, we are creatures of habit. We go to the same store, we go to the same grocery store, we live in our neighborhoods. And I remember a time when I picked my daughter up from school on Fridays, we'd either go to Chick-fil-A or the dollar store. That was our thing after school on Fridays. And I'm like, come on, let's go. And I told her, look, we are not going to the dollar store if you don't come on. And the little girl looked at her and she said, what's the dollar store? And the first thing I'm thinking is she don't know the dollar store, but she did not. There are no Dollar Trees in her neighborhood. So I kindly looked at her and her mom and said, it's the store where everything costs $1. Like, let's go. But she didn't know. She didn't know where she lives. There's no dollar store in her neighborhood, right? So I'm just saying, like, for real, because it's true. When we do the sleepovers and some of the students live in the same neighborhood, well, we don't live in that neighborhood, right? We don't live over there. And so sometimes the kids were doing things outside of school together because they live in the same area. Well, we couldn't really participate because we don't live there. Right. And that's just not our zip code.
Part of what I also work with is this, the assumption that because people are Black, that they come from a certain socioeconomic background. Right. And so we are also sort of fighting that conversation of, you know, the surprise that a Black parent shows up in a BMW, or the surprise that a Black parent, you know, has a certain level of education. And I think part of what often happens is there's a thought that, like, when we think about, like, increasing the diversity of the population, we always go to, let's increase the financial aid, which is really important to increase socioeconomic diversity, but it's not always correlated. It's not always that if you increase the financial aid that you'll get more Black families, because something that Winifred mentioned at the beginning, if I show up and I don't feel a sense of belonging, it doesn't matter how much money you're gonna give me, I don't wanna send my child there, right? I've been at other places where a parent, a Black dad, he had a real conversation with me. He was like, look, I know that this place is really good for my child and their learning, not lab, it was a different school, but for his identity as a Black boy, it's just not working for me. I can't do it, right? And so the additional work that we have to do with respect to increasing diversity is about belonging. That's for me why belonging is so important, but it isn't just about, like, throwing money at it. Right? Money is important. Yeah. I'm not going to reject the money, but part of it is, like, if you give me this money and the child comes here and, like, yes, they're learning, but they go home and every day they're like, mom, dad, like, I don't like who I am because, you know, I'm wearing a do-rag and people are questioning that, or people don't understand why my hair looks like that, or people don't know what the Dollar Tree is. They're like, the variety of things. Right. Like that's not the space that we want to be. And part of it is, like, we have to, as adults, mirror that behavior. Like, we have to ourselves show up authentically as who we are and diversify what it is that we talk about, right? Like, I watch trash television and I talk about trash television. Like, I read Noam Chomsky. I think Noam Chomsky is great. And I will watch 90 Day Fiancé. Like, you know, those are the things that are super important and impactful to me. And when we can be authentic with each other about that, that helps the students to be able to show up and say, like, oh, I like this, and not feel ashamed of certain aspects of their identity.
You know, I have had the experience of interacting and working with directors of DEI in school districts, as well as DEI directors in different corporate environments. And even a lot of the written materials kind of directed towards the DEI field. What I find is that oftentimes disability, more generally, neurodiversity sort of narrowly, is rarely a part of those conversations, right? We tend to ground it in sexuality, gender, race, economics, religion, right? But this aspect of human diversity oftentimes gets missed. And so I'm just, I'm wondering, one is, maybe with your colleagues who are also directors of DEI in other spaces, whether you find this to be true. And then I'm also wondering, because of where you are, the focus on neurodiversity, it's forced into the into the conversation. Whether you think that's maybe given you an extra added advantage or a different way of approaching the work that maybe your other colleagues maybe don't have.
I think into my second year at Lab, I had sort of an existential crisis about education, where I thought about all of the students who I had experienced in schools that were not schools for students who had language-based learning differences, that the behavioral challenges that we saw, or the sort of lack of motivation that some people said these students had, that they were tied to a language-based learning difference. They were tied to some other thing that wasn't, you know, a lack of motivation, that, you know, we recognize that the response manifests itself in certain behaviors and in ways. And if you have an understanding that, you know, it's not about hating reading, it's, you know, an embarrassment that I can't read, so I don't want to do it. And so I'm going to respond in this way. And I think part of what I have become even more aware of is the ways in which the institutions that I worked at previously weren't prepared to support the learners that I get to work with now. And I think what's so funny is I can't go to any presentation anymore without being like, there are too many words on that screen. All those words, you want me to read that? Like, and for me, it's not about my own, you know, I can sit there, but if I'm spending like 2 minutes reading what you have on the screen, I'm not focused on what you're talking about. And and part of it is how we give presentations at Lab and how we engage with students has really changed how I think about engagement. And so I really am overly conscious when I go to other spaces about how it is that things are working. You know, a simple thing is, you know, I'll go to a presentation and someone's like, oh, my voice is loud enough, I don't need a microphone. And I was like, you do need a microphone.
Oh, you do.
I was like, you always have to have a microphone. You can't assume certain things. You need to have a microphone. And I think I've become even more conscientious of those types of things in other spaces. Yeah. But I will say to your point that I think now some of my colleagues will come to me to ask sort of how we have the conversation about, you know, neurodiversity or, you know, disability. But I was like, well, it's like in the bones of the school. It's like it's how you send the messages, what message do you send? It's about repetition. It's about, you know, acknowledging, right, that like, that, you know, apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So when it comes to being able to communicate with parents, some parents may not be sort of avoiding you because they may have, like some students, opened the email, said they were going to respond, put the phone down, and forgot that they were going to respond to you. So like part of it is like, how do we think about the ways in which we're supporting students and parents who have language-based and attention-based learning differences? I think it really has shaped how it is that I think education should be. And I try to support, because I really like our academic club model. And the way in which that happens in our lower and middle school around learning history or social studies, if you want to call it that. But I think that more people should take that model because of how our students are able to really engage with history in a way that isn't the same if you just sort of sit them down with a book and say, read this chapter about, you know, this
Dr.
person.
Perry, I know, I just perked up that was my favorite. I always talk about it. You got to explain it. Okay, you got to explain it. I love the academic model. So please, for the listeners that don't even know what you're talking about, explain what the academic club model is.
Mm-hmm. And I will apologize to my fellow lab people for not doing it as well as they could. But I will sort of speak from the I experience is that part of what I like to do in my role is to just be present in the classes. And so one of the clubs that exists is something called Museum Club. And so they're sort of museum curators. They go through thinking about the variety of things. And one of the sessions that I was able to go to last year was they were talking about world religions. And so I come in and the teacher does a fantastic job of just sort of the space, like the space reflects learning. It reflects, you know, it reflects all of the things that she's trying to do in the sense of like, you know, it smells nice. There are incense. There are lots of things that are tied to various cultures that are part of the space. Like, so when they were studying, for example, Islam, they all had prayer rugs, right? And so they made them, right? And so part of the ability to recognize, like, just reading about a prayer rug isn't as successful as like you doing the work of like seeing it, making one for yourself, thinking about the amount of effort that goes into a prayer rug, how personal it is. And just being able to do that changes how students are able to learn because it's, you know, it's not that, you know, every student is Muslim, but they're able to engage with Islam in a way that is personal to them, right? And so part of what they also do is they will then go on a field trip where they will go to an actual mosque or they'll go to a synagogue or they'll go to a church. And so they're able to create for themselves the experience, but also then to see the lived experience. Additionally, there's something called the Renaissance Club. And one of my colleagues really did a great job of setting it up in that she diversified the choices. And so students choose a character from the Renaissance to be. And one of the things that she really changed about the curriculum was an understanding that the Renaissance you know, historically speaking, some people would say it happened in Europe and it was a European thing, but people were alive in other places during the Renaissance period. And who are those people? So she creates this environment in which, you know, if you are Mexican, if you're Black, if you are gay, if you are Jewish, you can find someone who existed during that time period to be that person and to take on that identity and then and to learn history from that perspective. And so I sat in her class and I sit in the Renaissance teacher's class this year. And so, you know, there'll be a question of like, okay, so in this period of time, like Mansa Musa, what were you doing? Right. And so like they are able to, because they're taking on that character, learn about that character, and they're the experts. Right, they provide the information in the class about that character because they're doing the work. And again, it's back to something that's interesting to them. It's about the teacher being able to know who they are and make adjustments, right? If that character you thought at the beginning was someone you're interested in, but you want to make a change, there's this space for that, right? And I think that that model of engaging gives students, you know, agency. It gives them agency over their learning, agency over how they show up in class. And it's just a fun history class. I mean, and sometimes I don't think that they know it's class, but it's not, you know, it's not the same. We don't come in, read a book and do it that way. I really enjoy that model of learning. And I will say, I will apologize again to my colleagues. No, they'll do a better job of explaining academic
You did a great job. The academic club, you know, just immersing yourself in that time period. I remember listening to an alumni of the other school, and she said in college, she remembered X, Y, and Z because she remembered being immersed in that time period, you know, and that's how she was so successful in her college class, because she, you know, was a part of the academic clubs. That's one of my favorite things about just the lab journey period, the academic clubs, because nobody else is doing anything like that. And I love it. I love it because they make food from the time period.
They do.
They get fully immersed in that time period. And it's like what project-based learning on steroids, basically.
Yes.
Integration on steroids.
Yeah. And that's the other aspect of lab that I really appreciate, is that, so if you, maybe you both will come back to lab and come into the castle. And so the Renaissance Club, the academic club, they created portraits of their characters. So they themselves, you know, drew, painted these really great portraits of their characters. They made the gold frame that's there. And so when you walk into lab, that's what you see. So like part of what I really enjoy about lab is that like the culture is on the walls, literally. You walk into the school and what you see is the work that the students are able to do and who they're able to learn about. And that's a question that, you know, that you get to ask. You're like, you walk in and like, who are they? And I would say like there are 8 portraits and maybe 6 of them are Black people. And so you like walk in and you're like, what's happening here? And I think that that's what I really like, is that the art, the teaching artists at lab really make an effort to ensure that art is a part of the work that students do and are able to express themselves.
Wow. Well, we should start winding down the interview. I'm going to tell you, this has been one of my favorite conversations. I appreciated the acknowledgement that the lab did for my work and then giving me an opportunity to really connect with the school. And Winifred, as long as we've known each other, was, you know, has just sung lab's graces and the power of their model. But when we were talking to Bob Lang, it's Bob Lang, right? At the lab? About sort of partnering and helping to sort of share the story about what the lab is. You know, we said we were going to interview people, and I said, I don't know who we're going to interview, but I'm going to make sure one of those folks is Dr. Perry. Because when I was first connecting with lab, I remember being in a prep call that we had with some of the staff. And I want to say, if you weren't the only Black person on that call, you were one of the only Black people. And I remember there were two things that you said to me that, again, made me want to connect with you more generally, but also be a part of this series. One was, you articulated how during the pandemic, there were some of your Black students who actually kind of were talking about an experience of a degree of relief from not having to navigate and negotiate being in predominantly white spaces, but still being able to get their education. And that rang true. I think that was probably an experience probably a lot of our students were having, but also even just more generally, I think there were probably Black folks all over the world who were like, I appreciate being able to still go through some aspects of my life and kind of have a break from, you know, these microaggressions and these other challenges. And so I appreciated you having that degree of connection to your community to be able to pick up on that. But then also, and you've said it a few times in this conversation, I asked just for any advice. And I think I maybe even asked you directly advice for how to show up in front of the students. And you said, you know, like, show up as your whole self. And I know that through like kind of hard lessons learned, but I appreciated you articulating it to me. And it is something that I have repeated countless times to other people. You know, I'm a poet, I'm a brother from Jersey, right? I'm a Black man and I'm dyslexic. And so it is important for me to bring all those aspects of who I am to all the work that I do. And again, that's like a gift you gave me. And I just want to thank you for all the gifts that you've given us over the course of this conversation. Maybe just the last question, as a school administrator, as a educator, just do you have maybe one piece of advice for your colleagues as it relates to supporting Black students and Black families who are connected to this topic of dyslexia?
I do. I would say that in order to sort of show up for other people, you really need to know who you are. You need to do a lot of reflecting on just sort of who you are and how you got to be where you are. I think the assumption sometimes is that because I'm Black, like, I know how to do this. And that's not true. Like, as a Black person, I still live in a society in which sort of white supremacy is a thing. And I had to make a concerted effort to recognize what are the times in which, you know, I don't show up as my full self because I'm letting the real world or the sort of what I perceive to be the repercussions affect how it is that I show up, right? I think simply about my nail color, right? That part of it is like, do I, you know, I'm a professional, like, do I paint my nails when society says that that's not something that men do? And I think when it comes to institutions where, you know, most of my colleagues are white women, I think part of it is a conversation that white women need to have with themselves about the ways in which they show up in spaces and how they show up in spaces can affect a multitude of things. That could be their colleagues, that could be their students, and being sort of hyper aware of that. And that, I think, this is a side note that I said to a friend the other day, is that I think Black men and white women exist in a very similar space, and that we have an identity that is marginalized and we have an identity that gives us privilege. And oftentimes when we run into difficulties is when we rely heavily on that marginalized identity to excuse some behavior that is about oppression. And so I think, you know, in a similar fashion, white men have the both of those privileges, and Black women, for example, have none of those. And so we are in this weird space where there are times in which that it will work to our advantage. And so I think part of the real conversation is like, how does that show up in spaces when you're trying to support kids or people who don't have that identity? You know, at Lab, I'm often telling everyone to do self-reflecting, and that self-reflecting is a daily thing. I have to wake up every day and sort of have that conversation with myself about the way in which I'm going to show up in the space, and also recognizing I'm not perfect every day and you're not going to be perfect every day. The day is the day. Like, you know, sometimes you didn't have the coffee. Sometimes you got to get gas. Sometimes someone rubs you the wrong way and that affects you. But I think part of it is when we build in those practices of reflection, then you can have those moments where you're, you know, I didn't show up like I wanted to today, but, you know, I'll do it better the next day.
Oh, that's thank you so much, Dr. Perry. Thank you so much. Well, there you have it. Another episode of the Black and Dyslexic Podcast with Dr. Anthony Perry. Thank you, and thank the Lab School of Washington. Thank you, guys.
Tune in next week, where we'll continue to bring you lived experiences and more unfiltered conversations with experts in the field around all things Black and dyslexic. Make sure you subscribe and follow the Black and Dyslexic Podcast, where we educate, empower, and equip Black and underrepresented minorities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is partially funded by Morgan Cares and the Center for Urban Health Disparities Research and Innovation, awarded by the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is sponsored by Dyslexia Advocation Incorporated, a 501c3 charitable organization located in Baltimore City, Maryland, whose mission is to equip parents of children with dyslexia and other language-based learning disabilities with the necessary tools to help their children become successful readers. You can find them on the web at www.soallcanread.org.